Interview with Cynthia Glassman, November 21st, 2005, at the Securities Exchange Commission, Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. I want to start by talking about your background. I have to say that I'm kind of pleased, after interviewing six people, you're the first one who hasn't been a lawyer. And I want to start by talking about how you got interested in economics, what your educational background was, and how you went into that profession.
Certainly, and I just want to say I'm very happy that I and all of the other women have agreed to be interviewed for this project. As the sponsor of the SEC Women's Committee, it was very important to us that this project was undertaken, and I was pleased that all the other former and current women commissioners agreed to be interviewed. So, to go to the first question. How I got interested in economics, and I've thought about this a lot lately, goes back to my father, I believe, who was a physician. I'm the youngest of two. I have an older sister who was never interested in business type things as we were growing up. But my father was the son of one of seven of a father who had come from Eastern Europe, built a business here, made a lot of money, at least it sounds like he did, and lost it all in the crash, but not in the normal way. He was in second mortgages, and he lost it all in second mortgages. As a result, my father was a very conservative investor, and he would talk to me about investments. When I was a teenager, he taught me how to read the stock market pages. He invested in municipal bonds. That was his major area of investment. When I went to college, I went to a women's college where economics was a very strong major. I went to Wellesley College, an all-women's college outside Boston, and they were very smart. The economics department there was very smart. They had one section of freshman economics, only for freshmen, in their first year, and it was taught by their best professors. So as a result, they attracted many more economics majors than they might have otherwise. And it became, and I believe still is, the biggest major at the school. I was actually going to major in math. That was my plan, and be a high school math teacher. But my math course was very theoretical, and my economics course was so much more interesting and combined some of the math as well as some of the business that I had been interested in. So I ended up majoring in economics. And then the summer of sophomore year, I went to another school. I went to Rutgers for the summer to learn how to program computers, which this is in the mid-60s. So it was before all of the computer literacy. I was going to be a computer programmer at that time. That was my plan. By junior year, I decided that I should go to graduate school. And in by senior year, I applied to several PhD programs and MBA programs and ultimately decided to get my PhD in economics at the University of Pennsylvania.
Did you go right through with MA, PhD?
MA, PhD combined. So that was straight from school. Now that blends into my first job, if that's where we're going next.
Sure. I mean, the question, of course, is you're getting a PhD in economics. What were you going to do with that?
I wasn't going to teach. I thought what I wanted to do was end up at a consulting firm doing macroeconomics and forecasting. That's when I started the program. But I found that the area that I was most interested in was microeconomics and market structure. So my plan at that point was still consulting, but when I finished my coursework and was working on my dissertation, which was on market structure issues in the computer industry, I decided that I wanted to work part-time because I didn't like just sitting by myself writing my dissertation. My advisor at the time, Al Phillips, contacted somebody that he knew well, who was the director of research at the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank at the time, and got me an interview for a job there. And they had a great program. And as it turns out, there were five of us in it when I ultimately started there. They would pay you 2/3 salary to work half-time on the bank's work and half-time on your dissertation. So I joined the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank under that program and very quickly changed my dissertation topic to banking so that all of the work that I was doing was related to banking. My bank work and my dissertation work, it all kind of combined. And that's how I got into financial services.
Synergy, I guess. Putting things so together so it all works along the same line.
Exactly, yes.
What kind of work did you do? You were involved with threats, I guess?
Well, it was mostly, at that point, banks. The Federal Reserve banks all had research departments that focused on both the market structure issues in the banking industry and then monetary policy and the macroeconomic forecasting. I was on the market structure side. And the work I did, at the focus of the group, that subgroup at that time, was on the banking laws in Pennsylvania. At that time, now this is in 1971 to 74 when I was at the bank. At that time, banks were limited in where they could branch, and different states had different rules. In Pennsylvania, banks were not allowed to branch outside of the counties that were contiguous to the home office of the bank. So the research group at the Philadelphia Fed was asked to do a project, a research project, on changing the banking laws to make them more liberal, make branching more possible. And that was my focus, and my dissertation was related to that, was on the effects of branching outside of those restrictions. Ultimately, the law did change, as it did in most states.
And
It was an old law, but it was not that uncommon for states to restrict branching. It was a competitive issue, or an anti-competitive issue, actually.
So you were at the Fed for a number of years, like 5 years?
I was at the Philadelphia Bank for 3 years. Then we moved to England for 3 years. At this point, I was married. I had a son who was a little over 2. My husband was a physician. He had been deferred for his specialty training in radiology and 1 year of teaching, and then he had to go into the military. So we moved to England. He was in the Air Force for 3 years. We moved to England, lived in Cambridge, which was about a half an hour from the base he was on. And I was still finishing my dissertation, and I became a supervisor at Cambridge for a class in economics for engineers. The system in England is different from here. When you go to university, you go for 3 years, typically, in one area, and you don't have any electives until your third year. So this was an elective course for third-year engineers. The reason I was able to do it, because it was difficult to get a job in England as an American, was that my training at Penn was pretty mathematical. The economists at Cambridge were not that mathematical. I had a friend from Penn who was on the faculty at Cambridge at that point. He was English. And he introduced me to a couple of the colleges that needed supervisors for this particular course. So I ended up doing the supervision, which is like a tutor at Oxford, the small subgroups of students in a big lecture class. I did it for three different colleges. And I also became a senior member of a women's college, Lucy Cavendish College, of which I'm still a senior member. I wasn't supervising there, but by being a member, I was able to use the university library, which I needed because I was still working on my dissertation. But I did finish my dissertation while we were there and flew back. I think it was after the end of my first year there. I flew back to defend it and then got my PhD while we still lived in England.
And so was it back to banking issues with the Fed again?
Yes. When we came back to the States, we were both we decided we wanted to live in a big city in the eastern half of the country and wanted to go to a city where we both got jobs that we liked. And Washington turned out to be the place. So I went to the Federal Reserve Board, where I joined the financial structure group, which was the equivalent group of the one I had been in Philadelphia, doing the same sorts of things, research, and then some cases where the staff would evaluate mergers or holding company acquisitions from a competitive perspective and present them to the board for votes on whether to approve them or not. I was in that section about a year and a half when I was asked to be the special assistant to Governor Henry Wallach. He borrowed a special assistant from the research division for a year at a time. And that actually changed my whole perspective. He was wonderful. He was incredibly smart, very articulate, had a very broad perspective. He spoke a lot, gave a lot of speeches. And as a result of being his special assistant, I was able to see a much broader, I got a much broader view of what the Fed did and the types of things that I could do. And I realized that I didn't want to go back to the section I had come from and continue to do that for the rest of my life. So after the year was up, someone whom I had worked with in one of the officers in the group was then on loan to the Treasury Department. It was the last year of the Carter administration, and they were having difficulty, as in any administration at the end, in filling some of the political appointments. So he was on loan as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Treasury for domestic finance. And he asked me to come over too, to be on his staff for that year. So I was on detail from the Fed to the Treasury and worked again on a wide variety of issues, many of which have been very helpful to me in my current position. I was the liaison to the PBGC, Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, which is much in the news today. I was the liaison to the Small Business Advisory Committee, and we have our own Small Business Advisory Committee now. I worked on legislative issues, so I had interaction with Hill staffers that I had never really had before from the Fed. And there were just a number of issues, much broader policy issues than I dealt with at the Fed. So, again, it was another broadening experience in terms of my career. When the year was up, I went back to a different section. I went to the capital markets section, where I worked on issues related to the thrift institutions and capital markets, small business, and securities-related activities to the extent that the Fed dealt with them. And that was the year that interest rates were sky high. And as the small business economist, I would get the phone calls that were meant for Chairman Volcker. And I remember sitting in my office holding the phone out about a foot as these small business people who clearly had a valid concern when rates were in the high teens or even low 20s were very upset with the Fed policy. And so part of my job that year was listening and conveying my understanding. There wasn't much I could do other than listen and convey the concerns, obviously, to the chairman's office.
Colt Volcker was quite the hero then that he is now.
Well, it was a very tough transition that we had to go through. There was no choice. It was a question of when, not whether. And he was very effective in getting rates down so that we can be in the environment we're in now.
So as you're going through these broadening experiences, does this mean you're moving into taking a more macro view of economic issues?
Not more macro, but a broader range of micro issues. Moving from very specifically banking structure issues, mergers and acquisitions and competition and bank mergers, to issues related to small business access to credit, efficient capital markets, the thrift issues, but adding to my portfolio of the micro issues. That's what was broadening.
At some point you wound up with a firm called Pure Ash.
Well, before we got there, there's one other important, two other important steps. From capital markets, I had told the division director that I wanted some management experience. I wanted to move up. And there was an opening in a section called financial reports for a section chief. And at that point, I honestly really knew very little about what that particular section did. But it was an opportunity to be a section chief. And what that section did was coordinate among the different divisions of the board and the reserve banks and the other agencies, all of the reporting requirements of the Fed, of the banks and the thrifts and anybody else that had to report something to us. That was all coordinated within this section. So it was less a policy section than a coordinating section. But everything was on a three-year rotation. So I was section chief for 3 years, and I actually saw all of the data that we collected over that three-year period. I had to work with the group that used it. And I learned some important concepts, such as GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. I had never had an accounting course. And regulatory accounting principles and all the issues surrounding how you get the information, how you design a reporting form to make sure you get the right information and make it clear, or hopefully clear. Now that, as you can imagine, has been particularly important in what I do now. Did that for 3 years, decided it was time. I'd been at the board for 9 years at that point. I decided it was time to go into the public sector. And I went first to a firm called Economists Incorporated that was started by three people who had come from the Justice Department. And their focus was antitrust analysis for mergers and acquisitions, but they didn't have anybody with a financial services focus. So I joined them, focused on financial services, although my work was really not the expert testimony type work that the rest of the firm did. But I did do policy work, financial services policy work for trade associations and some of the large organizations. Did that for a couple of years. It was a great firm. But I had an offer from Fear Ash & Company that was just too good to turn down. At Economists Incorporated, we were all economists, but I was the only banking person. At Fear Ash, where they asked me to be director of research, it was a bank strategy consulting firm, a small firm, but everybody had come from banking. And most of the people were bankers, so they mostly had MBAs. So there, I was the only economist, but we were all focused on the same industry. And I spent close to 8 years there, moving up from director of research to ultimately being one of the managing directors. But the firm was sold and the culture changed and there were some issues and a number of us left, including Ed Furesh ultimately. And so the firm doesn't exist anymore in that form. There's a small subset of it left with a different name. And I went to Ernst & Young. Others went to some of the other big accounting firms. And I spent 5 years at Ernst & Young, first in their risk management group, and then in their economics group.
Are you still leading research projects?
Throughout this whole period, my work was focused on research projects, policy questions, researching policy questions for my various clients.
And risk management, did that become
It did. The risk management was actually an exception to the policy research. I did do some research on it, but that was more client-specific, helping clients, large financial institutions, develop risk management frameworks, which I described as a bridge. If you think of all the different risks a financial institution has to manage as pillars, credit, interest rate, liquidity, operational risk, and there are 7 or 8 risks, that the framework was the bridge across the top. And having the framework was important to management to make sure that they were actually managing all of the risks appropriately and talking about risk in the same way. One of the most interesting exercises in each of those engagements was the first meeting with the senior management group, where I'd spend a day going through questions like, what is risk? And they typically had a different view of what risk was and how they were trying to manage it. And then I would ask them, what was their process for managing risk? And typically they really didn't have one. but this was maybe almost 10 years ago, 7, 8 years ago.
So these are business people working on instinct, I guess.
Right. I mean, obviously they were managing their risks, but they didn't have a documented, well-articulated framework, which has become more and more important.
Well, from Ernst & Young, you ended up coming to the SEC. Was there a Fed nomination or talk about that?
There were rumors in the press, but no. Those were rumors in the press. And what I learned with this administration in particular is that if you saw a rumor in the press, odds are it wasn't true. There have been some exceptions, but for the most part, they've been very, very good about keeping their nominations secret until they're ready to announce them. What happened was, once Bush was elected, I was very interested in being in the administration as a Republican. I'm a free market economist, and I feel very strongly about the Republican position, especially on business. I told my more politically active Republican friends that I was interested in a policy position if anybody was interested in me in financial services, and I filled in the information on the White House personnel website. And one day I got a call from somebody, a friend who'd been on the transition team, who said that they were looking for an economist for the SEC. Was I interested? And I thought about a minute, because the SEC was not on my radar screen, but I thought about it and decided that if they thought I was a potential commissioner, then I certainly was going to explore it. So I said yes. And within an hour or so, I got a call from White House personnel to set up a meeting. the first meeting, and they clearly vetted me before that meeting. And the meeting itself was more to get a sense of me and why I would want a position like this, not on my credentials. They'd already figured out that I had them. And I, at that meeting, at the end of the meeting, I said I was interested in pursuing this, and if they were too, it was important to me to meet Harvey Pitt, because I didn't know him, and he had just started as the new chairman. So within a couple of weeks, I got a call, and this is my deep throat story. It's really very funny. I got a call from Harvey's office to set up a meeting to meet him. But they wanted me to come in through the garage, not through the front door. So they told me, I said I would be in a taxi. They said, well, the taxi can come in through the garage, and our head of security will meet you there. So I told the taxi driver he could go right in through the garage, and he said, no, I can't. I said, yes, you can. And he did. They didn't stop him. We got into the garage. It was the old, not this building, it was the old building. And there was the head of security waiting for me. And then Harvey's, as it turns out, Harvey's, not sure what her title was, but his right-hand woman came down, and we went up in an elevator that was keyed so that nobody else would be in there. Now, they were doing this, I believe, to make sure that nobody saw me and didn't start any rumors. What I don't think they appreciated at the time was nobody at the SEC knew who I was. At the Fed, you know, if I'd gone to a banking agency, a lot of people would have known who I was, but not here. In any event, I went up and I was waiting outside of Harvey's office to meet with him. He was late. Harvey was always late. Reading the Wall Street Journal. I hadn't read it yet that morning. And it was the day that they had the Washington Wire, whatever it was called, on the front page with the little blurbs. There was a little blurb about the SEC nominations. And there were three names of rumors of who might be commissioners. Mine wasn't one of them. And that it was so funny because there I was talking to Harvey about being an SEC commissioner, and none of those three names actually ever was named. It all fit. So then I went to meet with Harvey, and it was a great meeting. We really got along. We talked about our philosophies, which are very similar. And we decided that if I were to be appointed as an economist, one of my focuses would be to review the regulations on the books from the perspective of whether they were accomplishing their objectives, whether they were efficient and effective, and if not, whether they needed to be changed.
Let's back up a little bit, because you said that the people you were speaking to in the administration said right out that the administration wanted an economist in the SEC.
That was what my contact, who asked me in the first place, said, that they were looking for an economist.
Did you follow that?
I was never sure if it was Harvey Pitt or the president or his advisors who thought it should be, they should have an economist. But it is unusual. Most of the commissioners are lawyers, traditionally. Occasionally an MBA business person. But there have been very few pure economists on the commission.
And when you came on, or shortly after you came on, there were two of them.
No. I was still the only economist on the commission.
Paul Atkins, I thought his background.
He's a lawyer. Oh, they may have economics undergraduate, but their professional degrees are lawyers.
Well, tell me a little bit about Harvey Pitt and working with him in the early years.
Harvey and I really hit it off well. We're both from Brooklyn. We're both about the same age. We had similar cultural backgrounds and philosophical views. So I really enjoyed working with Harvey. I communicated with him often. He was a big proponent of blackberries. Now, I was somewhat of a technophobe when I got here, and I wasn't sure how I would feel about that blackberry. But it turned out that it's great. I love having my blackberry. And when Harvey was here, we would communicate by blackberry all the time. He did with the other commissioners as well. But it was great because he would always respond quickly, no matter where he was. So you didn't have to try to get him on the phone or get in for a meeting. If you wanted to say something, you just sent him an email, which I still do with him. Not quite as frequently as when he was here.
Well, it sounds like the two of you were on the same page, so to speak.
Yes.
What was it that you wanted to do? You talked about looking at the rules and what was, broadly speaking, the idea of where you wanted to move the SBC?
Well, you have to keep in mind that between that conversation, which was in July or August of 2001, and the time I actually got here, some things had changed. 9/11 happened. Enron happened. And it was starting to become apparent that we had some very serious issues in the areas that we cover. I was nominated in December. Paul Atkins and I were both nominated in December, but we weren't confirmed, and we weren't going to be confirmed until the two Democrats were nominated. Now, normally there's one term up every year, but for a variety of reasons, some people had left, some terms were up, somebody had died. All five of the positions were filled by Bush in his first term. Obviously, Harvey was first, and then the rest of us, all four of us, were nominated by Bush. By December, they realized Ike Hunt, whose term had been up a year and a half before, was going to have to leave. The rules required that. And they realized that they were going to have to recess somebody into Ike's position, or into one seat. There were only three commissioners at the time, Harvey, Ike, and Laura Unger. And Laura's term was up as well, although she could have stayed a little longer. So they decided to recess Ike, because he'd already been vetted, and they recessed me. And then when the Democrats were nominated, we all got confirmed that following July. But I was here as a recess appointment from January to July before the others came. So I wasn't controversial. They just needed to choose me or Paul to recess so that there were three commissioners and at least one was a Democrat, so it was balanced.
Okay, so it was you, Icon,
and Harvey.
And Harvey. Just the three of you.
Just the three of us, and we had some very serious issues that came up during that period. We had the WorldCom vote, a number of serious issues. Anderson happened at that time too.
Tell me about the WorldCom vote. I mean, you're sitting down. And
The WorldCom vote was particularly interesting because I was on vacation in Portugal, and my BlackBerry didn't work overseas yet. It does now. But I did have my cell phone, and I started getting calls that morning after the restatement, I guess, became public. And one of my counsels was on the phone with me, starting 8 o'clock in the morning here, it was the afternoon there. And we had a vote on our action. I think it was that night or the next night. It was all scheduled, and I was at a restaurant in Portugal, had to go off in a corner, and Ike and Harvey were here when we voted on that action. That was totally unexpected at
so
that point.
Now and
Yes.
Is this the one that you had an action in place within 72 hours of the mistake?
Yeah, that was, we required of the certification. That was the first certification. CEO certification, I think, of the financials.
You had him certify his financials?
The companies, as I recall. And then soon after, we required the top 900 plus companies to do the same, as I recall. And then turned into one of the Sarbanes-Oxley requirements.
So clearly, you made the point that you had no choice but to be reacting to a lot of things.
Right. So then what happened was we had Sarbanes-Oxley legislation. We had a number of other financial frauds. We had the mutual fund scandals. A number of other things happened so that I never did get to the original project, which is still a good thing that I think we should be doing, to evaluate all our rules from the perspective of whether they were accomplishing their objective. However, I do use that thought process when we vote on new rules. And this is where my perspective as an economist is different from the lawyer's perspective, I think. I look at a proposed new rule or changed rule first from asking the question, what are we trying to accomplish here? What's our objective? And is this rule going to accomplish that objective? And if it is it going to accomplish it in the most efficient and effective way? Are the costs going to be worth, outweigh the benefits or vice versa? Are there going to be unintended consequences? Are we going to raise unrealistic expectations? And that's the framework that I think about when we talk about a new rule or changed rule.
The lawyers,
they too think about those things as well, but I think the sense I have is that they're often focused first on, do we have the authority? What are the precedents? It's just a different way of looking at it.
Is it that you're looking at structure, perhaps, what the bigger effects of things are going to be?
I'm not so sure it's structure, but I look at costs and benefits. That's my first question. Costs and benefits. Is it worth it? And is this the best way to do it? If the market will work, if the market will correct this problem, I don't think we need to be there doing it, because we will never be as efficient as the market.
And at this point, you've taken us into Sarbanes-Oxley past. Harvey Pitt is no longer there.
No, Harvey was here. Harvey announced that he was leaving on election night eve in November 2002 because of a big controversy over the selection of the new head of the new Public Company Accounting Oversight Board that was part of Sarbanes-Oxley. The whole tsunami, if you will, of that selection, I thought at the time, and I certainly think in retrospect, was very political, with a capital P, and was very unfair to Harvey. Harvey was being portrayed in the press as the kinder, gentler chairman, which... But they were his words, but totally out of context. He was actually very tough. Harvey had imposed what he called real-time enforcement. When there was the backlog of cases when I got here was surprising, the enforcement cases and the adjudication cases. Cases would come to us in the meetings that had, for voting, that had been investigated for 4 years, 5 years, sometimes the conduct was 8, 9 years old. And by that time, you lose evidence, you lose witnesses, they die, they forget. And so our enforcement wasn't as effective as it could have been. He, having been a former general counsel and being one of the most preeminent securities lawyers in the world and certainly in the country, realized that in order to really have an effective enforcement program, it had to be more real-time. We had to freeze assets quickly. Otherwise, you never got the sanctions, the penalties, the disgorgements, because the money was gone. So it was much more effective. We ratcheted up both the numbers and the of actions. We hit record numbers of enforcement actions while he was here. The whole tone of enforcement changed. It was much, much tougher than it had been. That was my impression. And I don't think the public appreciated how much of an investor advocate he was, how tough an enforcer he was. It all got subsumed in this political media frenzy, which was unfortunate because he was a terrific chairman.
I guess it's the phenomenon of once a story gets started in Washington, everybody likes that story.
Yeah. And the one thing that I thought back on what could have been different, I wasn't that familiar with the press at that point, because during the time that I was a recess appointment and before I was confirmed, I had been advised not to talk to the press, so I didn't. So I really didn't have good press relationships until, I didn't really start talking to them until after my confirmation, so that was August. This all happened September, October. And Harvey, I think, believed that he hadn't done anything wrong, which in fact he hadn't. And so he didn't have to explain himself, which he probably should have. Might have helped.
He was arguably, there's more pressure on the chairman of the SEC at this point than there had been. Maybe.
Since the beginning. I think that's right.
Was that circumstance, do you think that circumstance was extremely important, or do you think it just went on its own?
Well, to the extent that meant that we were in the, we and he, were in the spotlight of the press, it made a difference, because whatever he did or we did got magnified in a way that 5 years ago, or 5 years before, probably wouldn't have. I don't think people knew what the SEC was, most people, you know, 6, 7 years ago. When I, after this all happened, and I take a taxi cab, and my taxi driver would know what the SEC was, what some of the issues were, you know that it, you know, we've reached a completely different level of importance in society.
Was Donaldson waiting in the wings when
Harvey quit? Well, what happened was Harvey announced he was going to leave, but stayed on until his successor was not just named but confirmed. So Harvey stayed through February. So it was during that time that we promulgated just about every single one of the Sarbanes-Oxley rules.
You had, when Sarbanes-Oxley was passed, there were statutory time limits, 90 days, 180 days.
Right. Many of them were, as you said, 90 to 180 days. So within 6 months from that, I guess it was July, by the end of 2000, or by January of 2003, we had to promulgate all of the rules. And that was a very interesting time, because as you may be aware, the commission doesn't move that quickly in rulemaking. We take a long time to develop the potential rule. And when we finally vote on it, it goes out for comment. We get comments. We take a long time to look at the comments. So it's usually couple of years to put a new rule in place. We had 6 months for a very long list of rules. And I have to say, I think it was one of the most effective times I've seen since I've been here. I've been here now about 4 years. The staff was very proactive and interactive. There was a group from the chief accountant's office that would come by my office almost every evening around 5:30, 6 o'clock. I could expect them to, and they would come and tell me where they were on the rules and what the other commissioners were thinking. And so we iterated to a place where we all agreed. And except for the PCAOB chairman, there was really no controversy when we got to the end and voted on the rule. And the reason we weren't all sitting down and discussing them ourselves, of course, is the Sunshine Act. The Government and the Sunshine Act precludes us from meeting in private with a quorum to discuss policy issues. So the staff had to come to each of us. Our councils can talk to each other in a group, but we can't. So no more than two of us can talk when there's a full commission, which is the one law in Washington that would be first on my list to change. If I could change any law, it would be the Sunshine Act. I know it sounds great and it's hard to be against sunshine, but it's makes it very difficult to be collegial and to develop a consensus on areas where there are differences, strong differences of views.
Because
you can't sit down and hash out the issues and you can't come to a compromise easily. Your counsels can only go so far in speaking for you. And if you're talking one-on-one, you never get the whole discussion in one room and where you say, okay, you know, if we do it this way, I'm okay with it, but not if we do it that way. You just don't get there.
And if you're in the public forum,
you don't have that conversation in the public forum. You just don't. So by the time you get to the public forum, you know what you're going to say. And you say it. Each one of us says our thing, and that's why we had, well, that's one of the reasons that we didn't have better consensus on some of the issues that came up later.
Were people, I think, it would seem that you've got these deadlines and handed to you by Congress. I mean, were people running around going crazy just trying to figure out what to do?
The General Counsel's office developed a big work plan, which was critical to manage this process. So it was very clear who was on each rulemaking team, what the different steps were, what the deadlines were, what was expected of whom, and they really kept track of that, and it worked very well. Now, people did work long hours, there's no question. We all did, but the staff in particular. They worked very hard, they worked long hours, and we all knew, and Harvey was still chairman, we were meeting these deadlines. We were not going to let a deadline slip, and we didn't miss any.
General Counsel's office is involved. Commissioners are involved. What about the other divisions?
Everybody was involved. Oh, the divisions drafted the rules. And then,
was in their band.
Yeah. So, each office or division drafted the rules that were appropriate to them. And they briefed us, kept us informed of where we were. We saw drafts. So everybody at the commission was involved in this effort. And we did a great job, I think. The rules speak for themselves. I think the law was pretty prescriptive, so we didn't have a whole lot of leeway in writing the rules. But the one exception in terms of implementation issues is Section 404, the internal control section. But the issue there, in my view, is really PCAOB Standard 2, not our rule. PCAOB Standard 2 explains, provides the audit standards for what the auditors have to do to make sure the companies are in compliance with 404. And that's created, I think, undue burden and a misfocus on what needs to be done, and I think we need to open that up and readdress it.
Yeah, that was going to be the question. That 404 is the section in the
Sarbanes-Oxley. 404 is the section in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and it's only a few hundred words. Basically requires that CEOs have to disclose the effectiveness of their internal controls, and which of course requires that they actually review them, and they have a process for doing that, and that the auditors have to attest to the accuracy of the disclosures. I'm not sure I'm saying that quite right.
And they have to show that there's a plan in place.
Right. What happened, and our rule essentially said that, under Standard 2, though, the PCAOB said an auditor can attest to the process without actually testing the controls themselves. They have to attest to the controls, and that's a whole different focus.
Resources?
I don't think so. My view is it's misfocused. The point of this exercise in the law was that managements should understand the controls that are in place to make sure their financial statements are accurate. And so it should be a top-down, risk-focused exercise to make sure that the financials are materially correct. What it's turned into is a bottom-up auditor focus that looks at, in my view, looks at controls more for control's sake than the bigger picture risk issue. And why that matters is we may be having companies spend too much time focusing on these controls and missing the big risks. And also, it is taking resources away from other things, running the business as a business, other risks, because there are other risks than financial reporting risks. So I think it's a combination of misfocus of the objective, going back to what I look for, and misallocation of corporate resources.
Now, if this is an issue with the PCAOB's Standard 2, what can the commission do?
Well, we oversee the PCAOB. So, going forward, there will be a new chairman of the PCAOB soon. We need to work with the PCAOB board to rethink how the 404 requirements are being implemented. We had a roundtable, as did the PCAOB, or at least they joined our roundtable, and we put out guidance to this effect in April and May. We both did. The problem is the underlying language of the standard, AS2, is still on the books. So what I'm hearing is the guidance may say the right words, but if the standard's written the way it is, then the auditors aren't going to change what they're doing, because they're very concerned themselves. They're examined by the PCAOB, and they're very worried in this environment of not doing enough.
They just want to know how to pass the test.
Exactly. Yeah, if we tell them, if they know the rules, they'll do it, what the rules say, but right now the rules are pretty inflexible.
Something else that's going on in this time period, to add to Sophie's excitement, is you've got Elliot Spitzer running around getting in the headlines. You don't have to tell me what kinds of things were said about Elliot Spitzer at the time, but I'm wondering how the commission responded to some of the issues that he was bringing up.
Well, Elliot is very smart. There's no question. And he did bring out things that we hadn't, to his credit. But he did it in a way that was very different from the way we operate. We don't make public our investigations until we're sure there's something to be made public, either a settlement or litigation. But if we do an investigation and then we drop it, hopefully nobody knows and nobody's reputation was hurt. Spitzer doesn't seem to operate that way. And for some of the things that he brought to light, not all of them, but some of them, we were working on them. But
such as?
Some of the mutual fund issues, not the market timing. But there were some cases where we were there, but nobody knew it. And I know for the staff that was enormously frustrating because we couldn't say that because of the way we do business. And I'm much more comfortable with the way we do business in that regard than the way Spitzer does.
Were you working at cross purposes?
I don't think ultimately it was at cross purposes. I think our goals were all the same. We did all want to protect investors. But it was the emphasis and also the sanctions. We are the investor's advocate, and our mission is to protect investors and maintain the efficiency and integrity of the markets. But we are, at heart, a disclosure agency. And some of the sanctions that Spitzer brought, that we did jointly with him, and some he brought on his own, were much more micromanaging the business than we would do. For example, one thing that he did do that we would not do is, in some of his settlements on the market timing side, imposed fee reductions for the investment advisors. And our view, and mine especially, was that's not our job. We don't set fees. We can make sure fees are disclosed so people can compare fees, but we shouldn't be in the business of setting fees. That's not our role. So there were issues like that. The global analyst settlement, for example, was a compromise among us and 50 states and the NASD and the New York. It's a lot of fingers in the pie. It's not as streamline the solution as one might have hoped. But one point that hasn't come out in one of the areas that I'm particularly interested in is investor education. And one legacy that I'm very proud of is as part of that settlement, I asked Steve Cutler at the time if we could get some of the money dedicated to investor education. And I have to say, I was thinking, you know, $5, $10 million. We ended up with $87 million that was divided up among the states and us. And we got about $55 million, which took a while to actually get in place and doing something, but it's now at the NASD Foundation being used to promote programs and research on investor education.
What kind of programs? How is that reaching the general?
They haven't started using our money yet. They haven't, I don't think they've quite gotten it. But from my point of view, because I do believe in letting markets work, in order to have markets work, you need, there are two very important components. One is complete, clear, transparent information on the securities and on how, and on the markets. The other is investors who understand it. And as an agency, our focus is on good, clear disclosures. We have more to do there.
Talking about plain English.
Plain English, shorter, streamlined. We our mutual fund disclosures, for example, are getting, we keep adding things, we never take anything away. So they're getting thicker and thicker, and no matter how wonderful the information is that's in there, if it's too thick, nobody's going to read it, so it's not that helpful. But then the other side is investor education, and we have a terrific investor education office here. But we don't have the resources to develop a lot of programs. We're a good source of existing programs, and we have a great website.
Is that something new? That
Investor Ed?
Yeah.
No. Well, it was here at least under Levitt. I'm not sure if before that.
Going back to sort of the reaction to Spitzer and all that, I would think, well, certainly at this time, the press is involved and there's a lot of pressure for enforcement. People want to see things being done to the bad guys. Did the SEC's enforcement program or approach change perceptibly during the years?
I think it had already started with Harvey and his real-time enforcement. And we, as the commission, wanted the bad guys to pay, to be out of the business. We are all, since I've been here, all the commissioners have been tough on enforcement. Occasionally there's a dissent on some aspect. Occasionally there's a case that I think shouldn't be brought. Occasionally there's a case where I think the sanctions aren't tough enough. But with very few exceptions, we all agree and we're very tough on enforcement.
The issue of fines.
Court penalties.
Yes. It's becoming possible to take those corporate penalties back to the...
Through the fair funds. Yeah, that has been an area of some disagreement among the commissioners. My personal view is, and of course, I'm speaking only for myself. My standard disclaimer I forgot in the beginning. Only for myself. Yes, only for myself. I have no problem with imposing corporate penalties if the conduct has benefited the company and therefore the shareholders. For example, one of the best examples is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. If the company has bribed foreign officials, which is against the law, in order to develop business and get more profits, I have no problem with a penalty because the shareholders have benefited in some sense. But if the conduct, such as in a financial fraud, has hurt the shareholders, then I have difficulty with the concept of penalizing the company. I have no problem with penalizing the individuals. And I think that's a stronger deterrence anyway. Now, what complicates this is the fair funds, which is part of Sarbanes-Oxley, that enables us to give the penalty money back to the victims. You could always give disgorgement money back to the victims because you were disgorging ill-gotten gains back to people from whom you got them. But the penalty money used to go to the Treasury. Now we can give it back to the victims. But the issue, again, for me is when the conduct hurt the shareholders and the penalty in essence, is being paid by the shareholders. It's coming out of corporate funds. And you don't know if it's the same shareholders or different shareholders, and our process for getting the funds back through the fair funds is still being worked out. It's not as easy as it sounds. Then I still question the corporate penalties on that subset of cases.
Well, we've got to where Chairman Donaldson is coming in.
Chairman Donaldson came, yes.
Did the focus shift when he came in and you started meeting? Was there a sense that he wanted to change direction anyway?
Not initially, although I think that's probably true of any new chairman. It takes a while to gear up. He did support some rules that I was uncomfortable with. He was reacting not just to the accounting scandals in Sarbanes-Oxley, because by the time he got here, just about all the Sarbanes-Oxley rules were in place. But then we had the mutual fund scandal. That, as a result of that, we had a number of new rules, and we also had the securities market structure issues that have been going on and been discussed for a long time. And they finally came to a head in terms of new rules while he was here.
Let's talk a little bit about the mutual fund issue. Essentially, this is a question of the governance of the funds themselves.
Right. There were several different mutual fund rules. I can't remember the specifics, but we required compliance officers. Can't remember all of the other rules. The controversial one was the 75% independent directors and independent chair. And the ostensible reason for this rule was we needed better governance because of the mutual fund scandals. My problem with the rule was, number one, there was no evidence showing that this governance structure was better than the existing governance structure. And I had asked for research to be done, and we never did it. As far as we could tell from the anecdotal evidence, the market timing and late trading scandals, which was the catalyst for this set of rules, really, let me back up. At the time, 80% of mutual funds had inside chair people, and 20% had outside chair. Most of those were bank related because of the law at the time didn't permit banks to have funds with inside chairs. So we had information, and one could have easily evaluated whether funds with inside chairs did better or worse than funds with outside chairs. But we didn't do that. Well, that's a good question. I ask that it be done. For whatever reason, we didn't do it. In addition, when you looked at the funds that were implicated in the market timing and late trading activities, approximately 20% had outside independent shares, and 80% had inside shares. So there was really no evidence that it made a difference either to this particular activity or to governance overall. Now, there was some anecdotal evidence and a study by Fidelity that that was done, not by Fidelity, but was done for Fidelity by some academics, that has been criticized, but the evidence, any evidence I saw, suggested that there was no significant difference in the performance or the expenses of the funds with inside chair versus outside. So my view on that rule was I didn't see what we were accomplishing, and nobody had shown me any evidence to suggest that this change was going to accomplish its objective.
But there were some pretty strong views on the other side, nonetheless. You even
yes.
had the ex-chairman coming together and saying that this is a good thing.
Well, it was a motherhood and apple pie thing, but it sounded good. How could you be against better governance to combat the market timing and late trading scandals? But nobody had ever shown the connection between this board structure and the things that the mutual fund holders care about or the scandals.
Well, it's pretty clear where the mutual fund issue came from, and you had a dissent on
that. I did.
Was that a 3-2?
It was a 3-2.
Okay. One of the ones that I've got a question about is the hedge fund issue. Now, mutual funds, you know, you had the scandal that, as so often happens, the scandal that the attempt to make new rules. Why hedge funds? In 2003.
When Harvey Pitt was here, he asked that the staff in the investment management division do a study of hedge funds because they were growing rapidly, they were getting pretty big, and he wanted to see if they were becoming retailized, which is a word we seem to have coined, but if there were more small investors and investing in them directly or indirectly, and if they seem to be more conducive to fraud than other type of vehicles. The study was completed after Harvey left, and it went to Donaldson. And Donaldson read the study and decided that despite the fact that it found no significant retailization and no evidence that hedge funds were any more conducive to fraud than other vehicles, at least at that point, decided, nevertheless, that we should register hedge fund advisors. And at the time, we had some discussion over whether the study should be a commission study or a staff study with these recommendations in it, because these recommendations didn't match the findings. And so it turned into a staff study. It was not a commission study.
Whose recommendations?
Staff. Okay. Although I believe that Bill Donaldson influenced the staff's view of what the recommendation should be. I'm not quite sure how that happened. So at the time, and this is before the rule proposal was actually out, but the recommendations were in the study, I suggested to Bill that we do some more research, since we didn't find what we thought we would find, but hedge funds were still growing and significant, that we ought to figure out what we were really worried about and see if we could determine the best way of seeing red flags or potential problems before we promulgated a rule. And his reaction was that would take too much time, and he went forward with his rule. So I dissented both when we went out and when we promulgated the rule. And now we are trying, we have a hedge fund task force whose, and this was when Bill was still here, whose role seems to be to try to figure out what the red flags are, what kind of information we need. What I suggested, and this had been suggested by others in the comment period at the time, was, first of all, why don't we raise the eligibility requirement to keep it from being retailized, to keep investment in hedge funds from being retailized. But also, why don't we do, and this was suggested from the public, a census and some reporting requirements once we figure out what those would be that would be helpful. More systematic reporting that would give us the ability to compare and see exceptions, figure out what the red flags are, look at any cases we've had to see what information might have been helpful sooner to help us find it. And we are doing that now, but we didn't do it then. And my concern on the registration is twofold. One, the ADV form, which the hedge fund advisors will be filling out, really isn't that informative in terms of the kinds of information that might be helpful in raising red flags. And the inspections, which we'll be doing, again, it's not clear we know exactly what we're looking for. Our staff is not that knowledgeable about hedge funds. Hedge funds are very complex. We'll be perceived to be giving some sort of seal of approval just by the fact of registration, which isn't warranted. And we really don't have the resources. And the number of investors in hedge funds, Paul Atkins and I figured out, is well below a million. Paul came up with a ballpark of 200,000 compared to the 90-plus million investors in mutual funds. It just doesn't make sense to spend our resources this way.
Well, if you look at, what about the argument that you don't want another long-term capital management, you've got the Fed coming in and stopping this?
Absolutely. I agree. We don't want another long-term capital management. Our ADV form and our inspections, I don't think, would ever find a long-term capital management. That was a leverage issue and a very sophisticated models. That's not the kind of thing we would find.
Is that the one where you wrote a joint?
We wrote joint dissents on all three.
Okay. And as far as I know, it's the first, that was the first. Right?
Was that the first one? Oh, ever?
Yeah.
In the history of the commission?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
While we're hot, regulation NMS. Now, the National Market System has been coming on for a long time. How much concern was there before Donaldson came in? How much was the commission?
The tough issue was the trade-through rule in the ITS, the Intermarket Trading System. That was a problem.
Why?
Because the result of it was that the slow markets held up the fast markets. The floor markets held up the electronic markets. And you didn't necessarily get the best price. It was sort of a phantom price. And the market had to go reach out for the phantom price, which might not have been there. So you ended up getting a worse price than if you didn't have to do that in the first place. It would have been simpler to just eliminate that rule, the ITS rule, and let the markets actually work. But instead, we have this complicated rule that extended not just to the market where the problem was, which was the floor-based New York, but also to the NASDAQ, where there had never been a problem, as far as we could tell. No serious complaints. The trade-through rate was well below 2%, it appeared, didn't seem to be a problem, but we have imposed this solution on the NASDAQ as well as in New York.
But the whole premise of the national market system is to bring everything together. So
well,
it seems like that would be the intention.
If the goal was to bring everything together, we should have had one market. But we didn't do that. It's sort of the worst of both worlds, which is what we articulated in our dissent. It doesn't go as far as a CLOB, Central Limit Order Book, which would truly be one big market where you get the best price at the time. There is no time price priority still. There's just price priority.
Is the CLOB just too out there?
Not so much invasive. The concern was that you wouldn't have competing markets to develop innovations and new ways of doing things. And in fact, if you look at the innovations with the ECNs and the new markets, that has been very beneficial to the market. But with the NMS rules, it protects top of book at each market. But if the next price down in the market is better than the top of book in another market, it's not protected. So it there are anomalies that just don't make sense. And my understanding is that the implementation is going to be very difficult. We're already getting lots of questions. And Paul and I predicted that.
And one of the interesting things that happens then is you have your NMS rules, and then you have the New York Stock Exchange coming out with an announcement that it's going to require online capabilities. Now that does the same thing. Is this cause and effect?
Not in the way that some people have portrayed it. They just needed certainty of what the rules were. I don't think it mattered what the rules turned out to be as long as they were clear. And then they could go ahead with those plans.
How was, and by the time you'd gone through these three fairly, and they got to be fairly high profile, how were things going on the commission? So the numbers are like, well, 98% of what we're doing were, was this just a little blip that got, put out of proportion?
To some extent, it probably did get put out of proportion. These were important rules, though. And it's true that the vast majority of everything we did was unanimous. But on the subset of the handful of things where we disagreed, they were important issues, both in principle and in practice. My view is that we have some rules on the books now that shouldn't be there. If you're asking what it did to relationships,
the functioning of the commission.
Well, the commission continued to function. We had all our meetings and all our discussions with the staff. Wasn't quite as open as it might have been between commissioners and between all the commissioners. And with the staff, it wasn't as interactive early on. We had less input into rules as they were developing, certainly than during the Sarbanes-Oxley period, for example, where it was highly interactive. They were checking with us every step of the way to make sure we would coalesce to the same place. There was none of that. For the most part, rules were presented to us as a fait accompli to vote on or not.
Was it unexpected that Chairman Donaldson stepped down?
The timing was. I had assumed he would step down by the end of the year. I was surprised that he stepped down when he did.
Why did you assume that he stepped down by the end of the year?
I wasn't sure how much time he had committed to when he came. But he was commuting to New York. He had a young son, young teenager, who was in New York. And it just seemed to me that after he'd accomplished what he'd accomplished, that there was some point at which he would decide it was time to go home. I had never heard of Christopher Cox until he was nominated. But the White House wouldn't have asked us anyway. The White House never talked to me about Bill Donaldson either.
But of course, in between those two, you're acting...
I was acting chairman.
So you got the seat. What did you want to do?
Well, there were a couple of things. I wanted to make sure we kept on, that the commission kept on doing the commission's business. We continued to have the meetings on the enforcement actions. We continued to develop some of the rules. And there were a couple of rules, if they'd been ready, I would have gone forward with. But I was only acting chair for about 5 or 6 weeks, so didn't have much time. But I would have moved some non-controversial rules if they were ready. It's a very different perspective being chairman, because the chairman is responsible for the running of the organization, and in a sense the chairman is like the CEO and the COO. So although as commissioners we all have a vote, equal vote to the chairman on all of the actions. The chairman sets the agenda, decides what we're going to vote on, and also oversees all of the personnel and the IT and the management issues. And so in those several weeks that I was acting, I was briefed on where we were. We were about to begin the budget process. If Chris hadn't been confirmed before the summer recess, I was going to have to get involved in the budget process. So I had to be brought up to date very quickly on all these issues. The other issue that was new for me was the market watch. We had the London bombings, the London subway bombings happened while I was acting chair. And suddenly I was the one with the phone, being briefed every hour on what was happening. The question, the concern was, it looked, especially that particular incident, looked like it was happening at train stations. We're right next door to Union Station. We didn't know if it was going to happen here or not, so we had to have our plans, our contingency plans. Our market watch people are excellent, and they were already in touch with all of their counterparts, but I was in touch with Alan Greenspan and Secretary Snow and Reuben Jeffries at the CFTC, because we all had to touch base just to make sure we all knew what everybody was doing. As a commissioner, one doesn't normally do that. So there were a number of things that came up when I was acting chair that I never really had the reason to experience as a commissioner.
So you had another broadening of perspective.
Another broadening of perspective. Absolutely. My other goal for my acting chairmanship was to make sure that we didn't have any more bad press if I could help it. I succeeded in that one. As far as I can remember, we didn't have any significant bad press during that time. Well, we didn't do anything controversial. Exactly. I had senior staff meetings, and I emailed the staff when I started, emailed the staff when I finished. And I did take charge and do what a chairman would do, and I was prepared to do that until Chris came, whenever that might be.
So you've gone through these somewhat tumultuous early 2000s, and hopefully things have settled down a bit. What becomes possible at this point, besides the study that you talked about wanting to do when you first came in? What else is on the agenda?
Well, there are still a number of things that have to be done. We still have to deal with Reg B, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley bank push-out provision. Harvey had asked me to focus on that when I got here. I continued to focus on it with Bill. I'm continuing to focus on it with Chris, and I'm hoping we can come to some agreement with the bank regulators in the industry on a rule that meets our purposes and the legislative objectives without the burdens that were in the proposed rule.
You need to figure out what gets pushed out of banks into
broker-dealers. And really, what the rule does is it articulates how one determines what gets pushed out or not. And it's as it was drafted and as it went out for comment, it's very burdensome. I don't think it needs to be that burdensome. I'm sure there's another way of doing it. So we're still working on that. I think there's some disclosures. The point of sale disclosures, I think, are important. Point of sale disclosures for when mutual funds are sold by broker-dealers. I think the investors need to understand the conflicts, the potential conflicts, and the costs of the transaction itself, as well as the ongoing costs of the fund. That's taken a long time. We've done focus groups, use consultants to get input from real investors on what works and what doesn't. And I think we've come a long way in figuring out what works best. Now we've got to balance that with the costs that the industry says they will incur if we do it the way we propose. So we're still working on that. But I think we still need some point-of-sale disclosures. I'm trying to think what else is out there on the horizon. Hopefully stepping back and improving all of our disclosures. Some more plain English, some streamlining. Hopefully there won't be any more scandals, and hopefully we can be more proactive in developing new rules or revising old rules, eliminating rules, which is what we've been doing in the Corp Fin area with Securities Act reform and some of the other rules that are coming up.
Well, I'm interested, given your perspective on what you've done. Do you think it would be useful for there to be a stipulation that not have to have an economist? I mean, we've got the woman rule, obviously.
Well, we're past the woman rule because now we have two women.
Right.
So the woman rule becomes irrelevant. Once you have 2 out of 5, it's a non-issue.
That's great.
That's historic.
Yeah. That's a landmark, I guess.
When Annette was nominated or confirmed, I can't remember, my mother-in-law said, oh, she really didn't like that. She really didn't like having another woman. She wanted me to be the only woman. And I said, no, you don't understand. It's much better to have another woman than you're not there because you're a woman. So, the economist rule. Well, just like I wouldn't want to impose an independent chair or 75% independent directors on a mutual fund, I wouldn't want to lock in the makeup of the commission for any particular president down the road. I do think that it is helpful to have my perspective, which is different from the lawyers. I think we also should be using our economists more. We have a very good Office of Economic Analysis. We've got some very strong people in there, and we have been using them more and more. But we should, whether there's an economist on the commission or not, we should make more use of our economists on staff.
At this point, is there anything that you completely missed that you'd like to discuss or touched on too lightly?
I don't think so. Just looked at my list of things. I think we've covered them all. The only thing I would say in ending this interview is this has been the best job I've ever had. I've been working on financial services policy basically for my whole career, but I've always been, until here, I've always been advising other people on the policy issues. Here, I get to make the policy, or at least I get to vote on it. I don't always win, but at least I get to vote on it, and I get to vote the way I think is right. I'm really not beholden to anybody for my vote. And that's a very good feeling. So I've really enjoyed it. It's been an honor to be able to serve in this capacity.
Yeah. Thank you very much for talking.
You're welcome. Thank you.